Part of the RAF is, of course, the RCAF, just our neighbors to the north. And, Dave, you have flown a number of those aircraft. As you like to say, you weren't in the RCAF, but you flew a lot of their aircraft, including the Spitfire, including the P-51, and a number of others that I will let you talk about tonight. How do these aircraft compare, as Kermit was talking about, from World War One now to World War II? What do you think of them? Give us an overview, if you don't mind.
Well, I was recruited into the Vintage Wings flying group in Ottawa, which is the Michael Potter Air Collection, to instruct on a Tiger Moth. They had bought one, and it's a little bit of an idiosyncratic airplane. You know, it's a very British airplane. And that's what I did. I gave checkouts on the Tiger Moth, and after that it was a Fox Moth. And then I flew the Hurricane, Hawker Hurricane, and the Lysander. And in between, I flew the P-40 and the P-51. So I'm sort of left-handed and right-handed, if you want to put it that way. And I've flown. It's a very different philosophy. It works. The something like the Fox Moth, was the first airplane in England to pay its own way without a subsidy, would carry three passengers to go across the Thames or some of those other estuaries at 130 horsepower, 105 miles an hour, same load capability as a Cessna 172, and it accomplished that in 1931. You know, in many ways, they were very advanced. But you do sometimes sit in the cockpit of a World War II British fighter, and you wonder why do they do things like that? However, the Spitfire, they simply got a lot of things right. It's, even wartime fighter pilots who had a terrible experience, or sometimes many, and lost many good friends, when they speak of the Spitfire, they do with reverence, right? And when you get a chance to fly an airplane that, like that, you understand where it comes from. The airplane is a delight to handle and looks after you in many ways. Wonderful slow speed flying characteristics. At an air show, you can maneuver it very tightly in front of the crowd at fairly low speeds, you know, indicating 125 or 30, and pull a little G, and it's safe. It won't bite you. Whereas if you were in a P-51 Mustang, you simply couldn't do that.
Well said. You bring up the Tiger Moth, and a lot of people don't realize this, but the Tiger Moth, the C model Tiger Moth, which we saw in World War II in Canada, trained so many RAF pilots. It's really difficult to train pilots when there's a war going on in your country, so you sent them over to Canada, places like Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and all of these faraway places where the little Tiger Moth flew. And did rather well, trained a number of pilots, a number of British stations, and you bring that up. It is really a kickback to a World War One airplane. And I know, Kermit, you had a few of these from the Waldo Pepper collection, the C model Tiger Moth, but it's a much different airplane than the British Tiger Moth.
Oh, yeah, it was a great trainer. You know, back then, in 1939, 1940, they had the option of using Piper Cubs and Rocket Champs, because those were invented, you know, they had been flying at that point. But they decided not to. They wanted something a little more challenging, kind of like the Stearman here in the United States. They wanted something that would develop more skills, that would bite a little bit once in a while. And so the Tiger Moth was a very good trainer. I particularly like the British one, though, with the tail skid, no brakes. On grass, you know, the tail skid breaks you from astern, kind of keeps you straight. It's like throwing an anchor out or something like that. And it's a very gentle and pleasant airplane on grass. The C model, the Canadian one that we had to use in the winter, so we, you know, put brakes on it and that sort of thing, it really wants to ground loop, right? It's a free castering tail wheel, and on pavement, you really do have to watch it.
I may have some experience with that. Bay Minette, Mississippi. Ever been there, Kermit?
Say again?
Bay Minette, Mississippi. We landed there in a C model Tiger Moth. I had a cast on my left knee. The crutches were tied to the end struts. And for those of you who've been to Bay Minette, you know what I'm talking about, right? The Bay Minette girls are all there in the FBO, and they come running out after we did this very slow ground loop with the guy in the front who was supposedly flying it, who might be here tonight, so I better shut up. But I'm in the back, and these girls come running out, and they go, "My God, was that a ground loop?" And Dick, the pilot, looks at them, never misses a beat, and he said, "Well, yes." He said, we heard you'd never seen one, and we wanted to demonstrate it." And they said, "We hadn't. That's amazing. You did it with such grace." which it did. It did it very gracefully. And a little duct tape, we were on our way. Let's talk about jets now, because the RAF, you were a former F-4 guy. Group Captain Stevens. Talk to us about the Jets, and we'll let Steven chime in because he was the editor of Jets magazine over there. Tell us about some of the greats that you had over there. Of course, the English Electric Lightning comes to mind, too, but fill us in on that.
I'm a backseater and navigator, so I never got in the Lightning, but I certainly flew the Phantom, and that was hot, noisy, and smelly, but we loved it. It really was a fantastic aeroplane. It was very capable for its day, clearly, although we moved on to other things. But I loved flying the aeroplane. It taught me my basics, how to operate a radar, how to learn to be an air defender and a fighter guy. It was a fantastic aeroplane. The aeroplanes I flew were the ex-Royal Navy Phantoms, so they were all a little bit different. They didn't have things like GPS or INAS. We called it a hamster in a wheel, if you can imagine, just churning away in the cockpit there, and you had to keep your attention to it all the time to make sure it was accurate. And some of the aircraft still had the large oleo. You could extend the nose wheel oleo for taking off from an aircraft carrier. They'd all been disabled, but one or two still a little bit higher than they ought to have been, and getting in was quite a trouble with the internal steps that dropped down, so you could always tell which one you were in. But they were fantastic aeroplanes. But we had to move on, and I moved on to the Tornado, and that was a completely refreshing cockpit environment. It wasn't hot and sticky, and everything was laid out the way it should have been with TV screens, and you could actually see better what was going on and better radar and so on. So I moved on to that, but it was all amazing. Who wouldn't want to do that? As a young man, it was pretty good.
Stephen Bridgewater, who has the only guy I know that's ever bought a Nimrod from the government over there, but was a former director of a museum, and as we said earlier, the former editor of Jets, can really talk about this. Steve, what stands out to you? I'm going to put you on the spot here. What, not that I've done that at all tonight, but Stephen, what stands out in your mind as the quintessential RAF fighter, in your opinion? What do you think people think of the most?
I think probably people remember the English Electric Lightning as being the most dramatic of the British jets of that early era, but perhaps the most important was the Meteor. And of course, an example that we've got out on Boeing Plaza today, Gloucester Meteor T7. The RAF were flying jets in World War II. We'd got this aeroplane active in 1945, countering particularly the buzz bombs, the V1 doodlebugs that were coming across. They were actually flying alongside so fast that they could tip the wing on the V1, topple the gyro to get them down. So I think perhaps that was the most important of the aeroplanes, because that was the jet that we really needed at the time. But being on the front of the Cold War, we had a great indigenous industry developing jet fighters and jet training aeroplanes, things like the Fallen Gnat. There's a jet provost I noticed out on the square as well. So we've got a variety of aeroplanes, but I think the Lightning was the one that really captured people's imagination. It was the first British jet that could take off and accelerate through the sound barrier vertically. An aeroplane that is much missed by most aviation enthusiasts in the UK.
Well, hopefully one year we can have one here. I know they're working on one down there in Gulfport, Mississippi, sure, where the RAF former mechanics are down there, and a couple of aviators are hopefully going to have one going. Kermit, in your opinion, I'll toss it to you, most impressive, best RAF aircraft, in your opinion, where would you put that?
Wow. I would say, like in World War One, I love the Pup. World War Two, Spitfire is great. I've got a number, but I haven't flown them yet. But the Sunderland's great. Haven't flown Hurricane. Got a couple of Tempests that we're working on, but I've only flown the Merlin Spit. But I really, really like that. And you were talking about slow speed and all that. It's got kind of a normal airfoil on it. And when the Mustang came along, they were taking advantage of the laminar flow wing, which is not a great slow speed deal. So the Spitfire flies, more kind of like on the P-40 deal. Flies like a high-powered sport plane because it's got that more of a flat-bottom airfoil. But the Spitfire is a great airplane, no question.
Well, Dave, I'm not going to leave you out on this one because I want to hear your opinion. In your mind, where do you... You've flown it all, like Kermit. What do you think?
Well, if I'm going long distance, I'd much rather be in a Mustang. But if I'm flying an air show and I want to keep it close to the crowd, I'd much rather be in a Spitfire. The Spitfire has the great characteristic that after a hard, tight turn, it's still going fast. You can do the same turn in a Hurricane, but at the end of it, you're doing 110 miles an hour. The Spitfire is still doing 160 or 170. And if you have the power up and you offload it, that little wing, that slim wing, accelerates very quickly.
And Dave would know. If you could read his shirt here, it'll talk about the Potter collection, which I wanted to bring up because this is a 5,000-mile Goodwill tour that you've been on.
Yes.
In a Spitfire.
Yeah, 5,000 miles in a Spitfire.
Wow.
So this is leg 3 to get here at today, and I hope the rest of it works just as well.
And that's a very economical airplane to operate. So 5,000 miles in a Spitfire, that's nothing, right? That's like your Kermit brought the Mars up here with those guys.
I may have to speak to MasterCard about that, actually.
A gallon a minute in the Merlin.
Right.
Yeah. But just to explain that, we took over a project in Comox, British Columbia on the West Coast that was stalled for lack of funds and other things. And the promise we made is that we will take over it in its existing configuration, make the investment in all the big ticket items, and then bring it back and show it to them as a flying airplane to prove that they did the right thing. And a piece of history, you know, is still alive and flying and educating, commemorating, and inspiring. This is the only Spitfire flying in Canada and the only one ever built in Canada. So it's a worthwhile goal.
Well, Group Captain, let's talk now a little bit about the future, and we'll get back to some things in the past. Now, then we're going to open it up to you, the audience, and with some Q&A out here, because I know these folks have some questions, and as soon as the first brave soul asks one, everybody will have a question. So this is going to be fun. Where is the RAF going in the next 100 years? I'm sure you've been asked this, you're thinking about this, the great minds back in London are putting this together. Where are you going in 100 years?
Yeah, well, I looked in the crystal ball on the way here, but it was a bit cloudy. So if you'd asked me in 1918, where's the RAF going to go in the next 100 years, who could have said, standing here today, that we'd have fighter jets, stealth, unmanned aircraft, etc.? I mean, it's so hard to predict. I think we can say that it's all about information. It will be a mix of unmanned and possibly manned, but in 100 years, who knows? It will include space, it has to, and you know, stuff like cyber, which isn't very sexy, but it's a very important part now because everything's about information and controlling information. So,
well, and our aircraft are now connected. I mean, they're all
correct.
Nodes on
they're
a network
all
at this point.
Interconnected. So, right. Everything's about connectivity and understanding what's going on as fast as you possibly can. So that's where we're heading. In the immediate future, obviously, F-35's dominating the headlines, and rightly so. And the RAF is part of that story. And as some of you will know, revealed last week, a Tempest project at Farnborough International Airshow, which is basically the Air Force saying we're still in this game, but we don't know what it's going to be. But it'll be stealth, information, manned and unmanned, and it's going to be flying by 2035. So that's exciting. But
it is
beyond
exciting.
That, my crystal ball's kind of hazy.